Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now...
It is a Thursday, it is mornings, and although Zan is away, Zanin is with you, that's my name. And of course, the wonderful Dr. Carl, the man who bleeds scientific facts, lives for it. And we have some, a whole bunch of questions. I'd like to start with one this morning, if I may, Dr. Carl.
Yeah, but can I just make an ever so small correction to your fine introduction?
Please.
I'm not that wonderful. And number two, when you say facts, in the same way that a house is built of stones, but it's more than just a pile of stones. Mm. Science is built on facts, but it's more than just facts.
Yes.
Okay.
The sum of its many parts.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
My question is regarding a guy named Ray. You're going to have to help me with his surname. Ray Curlwiz.
I'm just looking him up on the Font of All Knowledge on the Intertube, which is Wikipedia. K-U-R-Z-W-E-I-L, Kurzweil.
Kurzweil.
Now, he's a pretty smart guy.
He's a very smart guy. He's worked with Bill Gates. He's worked with the US government. He's an inventor. He invented the flatbed scanner. He helped invent, I think, the electronic piano with Stevie Wonder. There's a film coming out about this guy and his theories. And his theories...
And something about a reader as well. Yeah, and his theory...
His theory is basically that... That science is and our technology is always getting more and more advanced and more complex. And he talks about when he was at technology school that all the students had to share one computer that was the size of a house, basically the size of a room. And now, in this day and age, everyone has computers in their pockets, in their phones, 1,000 times smaller and 1,000 times, just like that phone, 1,000 times smaller and 1,000 times more complex and smarter. And so the basic theory is that, science is always getting more and more complex. And he basically thinks he's going to live forever. He thinks that within his lifetime, there's going to be technology which will allow us to more or less live forever. He thinks there's going to be tiny nanotechnology, tiny little robots, we'll either breathe them in or inject them and they'll be able to go around our body and get rid of cancers, things like this. And his main theory of singularity is that humans are going to need to merge with robots in order to keep up with the technology. It'll be moving and advancing that quickly. There'll be so many new inventions and become so complex that we're going to need to merge with robots and technology. I'm just wondering what you know about this theory, if you know anything about this man and what your thoughts are on it.
Okay, well, firstly, this discussion would take a couple of hours in a pub with maybe, for me, a lot of beer, maybe two or even three glasses. I'm lucky. My son seems to have no limit to the amount of alcohol that he drinks, and so therefore he can get very stupid. I'm very lucky because I drink three glasses and I vomit. The fourth glass I vomit.
Really? Four and you're vomiting?
Yeah. And right. So that way I know how to control my alcohol. And the trouble is that people get to the stage where they have too much and they don't know what they do, and then the movies come out and it's really embarrassing. Not with my son. Okay. Firstly, he's right. The technology is advancing incredibly rapidly. I know some people at the University of Sydney who are so old that they were there when the intertubes first started off in December 1990, when they had the first HTTP protocol, and they remember the web when it had two home pages.
Wow.
And one of them was
but see, that wasn't
physics,
very long ago, really,
1990.
Was it?
Yeah, and the other homepage was the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. That's how old they are.
That's the thing. It sounds like ancient history to very young people, but it's not long ago, and these
That's
technologies
right.
are changing the world so quickly.
Yeah, right. Now, let me tell you how advanced the technology is. It is so advanced that you can't fix it.
How do you mean fix it?
I used to have a 1954 Chevrolet. I like American iron.
Mm-hmm.
It's artistically beautiful. Don't worry about the safety, the pollution, all that sort of stuff. But artistically, the 59 Cadillac with convertible, with big wings, pink, is beautiful. You can't fix the technology. Back then, you could fix technology. If you have a phone or a computer, in many cases, if it's 2 years old and a 2 cent part has failed, you may as well throw away the whole thing. Because the cost of getting a new one is only a little bit of fixing it is only a little bit less than getting a new one.
Okay.
So the technology's advanced so rapidly that you can't fix stuff anymore. It's cheaper just to throw it away, which I think is an incredible waste. So he's right, the technology is advancing very fast. Moore's law, electronic components are getting twice as powerful every 15 to 18 months. They've been doing this from 1945 to 1960 when Gordon Moore, who set up Intel, which makes 80% of the computer chips known today, came up with this law that the electronic components are halving in size and doubling in power every 18 months. And they've been doing it all the way from 45 to 60 and from 60 to now, and they'll keep on doing it. So how are we going to be able to deal with it? He's saying we should get technological implants. And I can foresee, for example, the case where you have a computer the size of a grain of sand buried near a nerve in your body. And when you happen to...
How far away do you think that kind of technology is? Like
20 years. Right. And, okay, different thing. Read anything you can by a guy called Richard Feynman. And he once gave a lecture called There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom. And he said that if you could store one piece of information on a single atom, you could store all the information ever generated by the human race in its entire history. From the first cave paintings, every grunt, every word ever spoken, every thought ever thunk, every computer program, every videotape, everything could be stored in a volume smaller than a grain of sand. And if you use some fancy physics, you can start storing information near electrons.
Do you think that's possible? That we could actually get to the point where there's computers the size of atoms?
Yeah, well, the one bit of information could be stored on an atom. So you could store all the knowledge known to the human race on a grain of sand. And so when you get on your bus in the morning, and you wave your arm, and it, thanks to this computer the size of a grain of sand, it then automatically debits $50, which is what it'll be to catch a bus in 20 years' time, mm-hmm. into town. At the same time, it also updates you with all the knowledge that the human race knows. And if somebody wants to ask you something important, like with regard to Australia's most popular sport, which is, what is it, Zanon? Putting on a spot, no notice. What's Australia's most popular participant in sport? Women's netball. You were dead
netball,
right.
Women's netball.
So with regard to women's netball, what's the relationship between the rainfall in the towns where the participants were born and their height? That information will just pop up in your brain. Wow. Because you've got all the information known to the world loaded onto a computer chip, which is buried in your body.
So we're going to become cyborgs, more or less.
Well, yes and no. I think that he's sort of missing the boat a little bit, and I don't want to be arrogant here, but he didn't have the advantage of 10 years of medical study that I had paid for by the taxpayer, and I'd like to thank the Australian taxpayer right now for my $250,000 worth of education. And the idea of nanobots that go around your body removing cancers is good, but it's better just to use biological things.
Sure.
You can run your body for a whole day on a plate of food. You try running a robot on, you know, a bunch of sugar. Forget it. You need a couple of kilograms. You need all sorts of energy to run a robot. The human body is incredibly efficient. So what you do is modify the DNA, and I agree with him about living forever. Okay. I'll just bring this to a complete close right now. But every cell in your body has a clock which tells it to die. This is called apoptosis, A-P-O-P-T-O-S-I-S. There's a story on my homepage, Dr. Carl's Great Moments in Science on the ABC site, called Suicide Cells. Every cell is programmed to die. We can find that program and switch it off. By the way, you're supposed to die to make way for the next generation. No hard feelings. If you have your kids and by the age of 25 it's time to die, they're okay, right? So if we can find this program and remove it, we could live for 500 to 5,000 years with a healthy 18 to 25-year-old body by genetic engineering of the body that we have and keep it at that 18 to 25-year-old stage. Once you've hit 25, mate, you're pretty well over the hill. Because you're just heading down, and between 25 and 50, you'll double the amount of fat you carry on your body unless you're careful. So basically your days are over. But why stay with this? According to Freeman Dyson, the proper shape for a human being, getting back to Ray Kurzweil and the singularity, is a 50-kilogram lump of iron vapor the size of a planet floating in space. What makes you a human being is not whether you've got two arms and two legs, the fact that I can talk with you and we can share things and we can communicate. And if you can communicate with a cloud of iron vapor, well, then that's human, close enough. And you can still have sex, because remember Frank Zappa said your main sexual organ is your brain, and you can navigate through the solar system and through space on magnetic fields. So, yes, there are great changes coming, but they'll come via genetics. Ray Kurzweil, I think, has got it right that technology is going to push us, but the really big technology will be manipulating the DNA.
Wow.
Because I think we've got a mistake with our brain inside this bony cavity at the end of your skull. I reckon the brain should be in your gut. Out of the way of
her. So there you go.
Sorry, I told you it would take a couple of hours.
Well, yes. It is a lot. But, I mean, it's important. We could be living forever. This is news to a lot of people, I think. All right, let's go on to some callers.
Yeah, go with callers.
Let's go with Dr. Stewie.
Dr. Stewie?
Dr. Stewie.
Yeah, g'day, Dr. Zen and Dr. Carl. How are you going?
Very well, thanks.
And thank you for your patience, Dr. Stewie. Yeah,
thank you for your patience. Question regarding caffeine.
Yes.
Yeah. I've never been much of a coffee or tea drinker, and I find that my concentration levels are really low when I, like, read a book or sit a lecture. And I was just wondering if coffee drinkers have the edge on me because of the caffeine, or is it just that they're feeding their addiction? So if I start drinking caffeine drinks, can I get high concentration levels?
Are you a student? Or
yes.
And are you, could you absolutely love to pieces?
Absolutely.
Oh, well, that's good, because that's a very important thing to do at your love. And what are you studying?
Education.
And you're in which year of university?
My final year, believe it or not. Fourth year.
Did you have a break between high school and university?
Yes, very long break.
Oh, that's good. Okay, and you're saying you're having difficulty with concentration.
Yeah, I'll sit down to read a book and my mind will just wander.
Are you listening to the evil iPod at the same time?
No, not at all.
And you love what you're doing?
Yeah.
But your concentration will just wander. It's not as though you're bored, you want to do something else.
Yeah, even when I read novels and stuff like that, I'll be right into the book, but I'll still concentrate. I'll sort of lose concentration.
Have you tried having coffee, and does it help your concentration for you?
I've never tried it because I don't really like the taste of it, really.
I'm with you there, Stewie. I think it tastes awful.
What about the smell of it, though?
Smells quite good.
Yeah, it smells good.
Okay, look, number one, it is a bit of a disappointment that the smell is better than the taste. Number two, if you get the right sort of coffee, it can actually taste pretty good, but it never tastes as good as the smell. Number three, a lot of studies show that it's a remarkably benign drug and that it will improve your concentration.
Okay.
But you can get addicted to it. Yeah. I had a friend who actually killed himself with coffee by actually eating the coffee powder out of large jars of the stuff, which is a stupid thing to do. And another disadvantage is that if you learn something when you're in a particular mindset induced by a drug, be it caffeine or alcohol, I'm sorry to say you'll be able to remember it better in an exam when you have the same drug floating in your blood system.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, so that would mean that you'd have to have exams on it. Now, it is not Triple J policy that we recommend that anybody take drugs.
That is true. However, we're not about to start, are we, Dr. Carl?
But caffeine is the world's most popular legal drug. Mm. It has remarkably few side effects, although it can set off atrial fibrillation in some people and make their hearts go funny. And my wife and I were travelling through New Zealand and she said, "There's something funny with my heart." And I said, "No, bullshit." She said, "Have a feel." And I had a feel and heart was going boom, buddy, boom, buddy, boom. So now she has to have weak coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Third size. Complicated thing. You've touched on a lot of things there, Dr. Stu. Try it. But if you end up, like, what's the guy who used to be really smart friend, the drunk guy in The Simpsons?
Barney.
Oh, Barney.
And if it turns out that coffee turns you into a dribbling idiot and then you're just always getting coffee highs, maybe you shouldn't go down this pathway. It's really hard. But it does actually improve your concentration. And so, I'm sorry to say, does tobacco, except tobacco has a very high price that it takes on you.
No, I don't think I'll go there.
So there you go, Stu. It could be some advantages, but also some disadvantages.
Yeah.
Look,
all drugs are poisons. What matters is the dose.
That's true. All right, let's go one more very quickly. Yeah. Dr. Ben from Yarraville, the question is regarding ADD medication.
Hello, Dr. Ben. Dr. Ben, have we been talking too much? We may have lost Dr. Ben. That's my fault.
His question was ADD medication. Is similar to the drug Speed in terms of its effects, and he wants to know why are we giving kids with ADD Speed or something that has a similar effect to Speed.
We don't know how it works. Mm. We know that it does. I've spoken to various people about this, and they've told me their experiences, including people like Norman Swan on ABC Radio, who it sort of goes like this. Well, I never really believed in ADD until we did the TV interviews. We turned up at this house and there was this kid and he couldn't stay still. And in the course of 3 minutes while you were just saying hello, he would have pulled the bookcase out and then got a bag full of things and tipped them upside down and run around the room, done some head. And he said, when they take the medications, it makes them better. For many, many people who actually, and there's not that many people who have ADD, but of the ones who have it seriously, they would be so much better off in a hunter-gatherer society where their job would be to stay awake at night and look out for the animals that are coming to kill you and be hunters. And in a society where you're supposed to sit down and study and not make too much noise, it just doesn't suit their brain. Mm. And the medications work. Not sure why.
So it has the reverse effect. So people with ADD...
opposite of what you would expect, yeah. I don't understand
That's
why.
Strange. Should we take some more questions?
Lay it on me. Although I'm not a real doctor, I'm a medical doctor. I don't have a PhD.
okay, let's go here. Dr. Wendy.
Hello,
yes,
Dr.
Hello.
Wendy.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Wendy.
You have a question regarding eggs on mountains.
well, I'm a chef, and in the kitchen we've been having a discussion about the boiling point of water. And down here at sea level, it's about 100 degrees or so, but I know that as the altitude gets higher, the lower of the boiling temperature gets lower.
Mm.
So my question is, if you were very hungry and you found yourself on Mount Everest with an egg and some water, could you boil that egg and eat it? Because I know that eggs don't start to cook until about 70 degrees or so. Would the water be hot enough to cook that egg?
I don't think so. When I was in the Himalayas a couple of years ago, we had some pasta. And I saw the pasta go into the boiling water, and the water was boiling, but it was only about 80 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And so when it came out, it was very al dente, very on the teeth, very hard. And as they said, it didn't matter how long you boiled it for, you wouldn't get above whatever the temperature was, 80 or whatever it was for boiling water, 85 or I don't know the exact number. I think on Everest, the temperature would be below 70. I don't know the exact number, and maybe somebody can give us the answer, but you're dead right that the water can boil, and I believe that there's a certain altitude at which the water can boil, and as you just put your hand in, it's just like skin temperature. I don't know what the numbers are. Somebody will ring us in. That's a very good question. I don't have the answer.
All right, so you'd end up with at least a very soft-boiled egg, maybe.
That's right. But definitely, I remember having bad pasta. We're only at about 3 or 4 kilometres, nothing.
Thanks very much for your call, Dr. Wendy.
Dr. Wendy, we hope to have an answer soon on that one.
We hope to get an answer to you ASAP. Michael from Canberra. Dr. Michael.
Hello, Dr. Michael.
Doctor.
Hello, doctors. How are you going?
Doctor. Hello. Ignition coils in cars. You have a question for Dr. Carl.
I do indeed. I've got an old Morris Minor, and she broke down the other day, actually on the way back from one of my exams, and which is actually good timing. But when I was replacing some stuff, I just thought to myself, I don't actually know how an ignition coil works. I understand how one would for an AC circuit with the alternating current, but for a DC circuit, which, well, obviously the car is, how does it transform the voltage?
How does it go from AC, from DC to AC? I don't know. Do they have a make and break circuit which makes a fake square wave AC?
No, it's all the inputs are, it's got a two 12-volt inputs, the plus and minus, and then the high tension lead out. And I think all that's in there, all that I can see, well, I haven't pulled one apart yet, is just a coil, and it's got a oil just to distribute the heat a bit better.
Okay. With a normal transformer, works like this. Imagine you've got a cotton bob, you know, a cotton reel, and you wrap some wire around the outside, a whole bunch of turns of wire, and then you drill out the center of it, and then you get a pencil and you wrap wire around that and you put that inside. So you've got two coils of wire, one inside the other, and the voltage will jump up and down depending on which way you run in. Now, you've got to have it AC. I think that what happens in the ignition coil, rather than a smoothly varying AC which goes positive, smooth sine curve up to negative, positive, negative, 50 times a second, I think what you've got is a square wave that brutally goes positive, negative, as the ignition coil, as the points open and close. I'm just guessing on this.
Yep.
You know, I used to be a bit of a car mechanic, and I never asked that deep question. That is such a good question. And the answer is I don't know. I think it's like that. I don't know, and maybe somebody will give us an answer. And look, number one, it's good for you to have that Morris Minor, but two, they don't have the safety features of today's cars.
Yeah. I only drive to uni every now and then, so it's not a big deal. I'm up to Canberra tonight, so not driving.
Okay, look, we'll try and get an answer for you. That's a deep question, transformer coil.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Michael. And I think you should do what I do, which is keep the NRMA number very handy. At all times, saves you learning too much about engines.
It's good to learn.
It is good to learn, though. Dr. Stu,
come on down, Dr. Stu.
Yeah, g'day, doctors. How are you going?
Very well, thank you.
Doctor.
My question has to do with rainbows and whether they extend into the infrared and ultraviolet spectrums. And if they do, I'd imagine there's a point halfway in between the primary and secondary rainbows where the wavelengths are actually equal.
Okay. With a rainbow, what happens is that you're standing out in the open and the sun is shining on the back of your head. Right? And in front of you is a nice black storm cloud, which provides a perfect backdrop to see a rainbow. So you look off to your left about 41 degrees, and there's a raindrop in the sky. And the beam of light from the sun behind your head hits that raindrop, goes into it, and enters into the raindrop, hits the back wall of the raindrop, comes out through the front wall, and then is bent again and comes into your eyeball. With regard to visible light goes peachy keen through glass and through transparent water. Ultraviolet is absorbed like buggery. So you're not going to get an ultraviolet rainbow. However, I do remember having the experience on a boat of having the sun shining on the water, and I just suddenly felt this blast of heat coming off the water. So I reckon there would be infrared rainbows. And so what we need is somebody has set up an infrared camera at a rainbow. And this, I don't think anybody's ever taken, I do not think anybody has ever taken a photograph, Dr. Stu, of a rainbow in the infrared. I think this would be a world first.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I've actually performed the experiment, but it's a bit hard to get a hold of that sort of equipment.
Infrared cameras used to need liquid nitrogen, but now they can run on fancy solid-state stuff which cools down the sensor via electricity via the reverse Seebeck effect. If somebody out there can do it, that would be a world first. A rainbow in the infrared. Look, I reckon it would work.
There you go. If you're listening and you want to be a pioneer in rainbow research and impress Dr. Carl, get your hands on an infrared camera and take a photo of a rainbow. Thank you for your call, Dr. Stu.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart.
We do also have another guest in the studio. And I can call him wonderful, and I know he won't correct me. He goes by the name James West from the Almighty Hack Team. James, you've been doing Man Week all week.
Yeah, that's right, Doctor. Do I have to call you Doctor as well?
Well, this is the one time in my life I get to be called Doctor.
All right. Dr. Zanon. Hey, look, Dr. Carl, a quick question for you. All week on Hack this week, we've been tackling the inside of men's skulls. So
really
everything from
topic,
really huge topic, yeah. You know, mental health issues, alpha male. Tonight we're talking about becoming a man and your relationship with your father. But I thought with you I could clear up a few myths about being a man. Firstly, do men fart more than women?
Slightly more, 14 times a day as opposed to, I read about this in my 20th book, and women 12 times a day, total volume about 1.5 litres.
God, that's a lot of farting.
There's a bacteria. Do you know that you would think, James, that your body is made up of James-type cells, of Jamesness?
Mm.
90% of the cells in your body are not James. They're bacteria.
Disturbing.
There's 1.5 kilograms of bacterial cells, which make up 90% of the cells in your body. They're really small cells. So 90% of the cells in your body are bacteria, which extract more out of the food.
Mm.
And so if you didn't have them, you'd have to eat a lot more food to get the nutrition that you need.
Do men talk more than women?
I wrote about this in my 26th book. mate, I'll just quote. Here we go. Women speak 20,000 words a day, but men only speak about 7,000.
Wow.
That's what they claim. Right? Mm-hmm. And it goes back.
Really? Women say 3 times as much as men?
That's the myth, man. Don't believe it, man. They're lying to you, man.
All right.
Okay. It was Mark Lieberman, the professor of phonetics at the University of Pennsylvania, who made his personal duty just to track this one down. And he managed to track it down to a 1993 book. It was written by James Dobson. It's a religious book. It's full of Bible-based insights. And it's called Love for a Lifetime. And the exact quote is, with zero evidence, the exact quote from this book is that women speak 50,000 words per day while men can only manage 25,000 with zero evidence. Why do so many Christians have to lie for Jesus? I do not know. And then it just went straight through the entire world media because everybody just loved it until finally somebody did the experiment and found it's not so. And in fact, the bottom line of it is, and I'm just flipping down here on my little computer screen, in this particular study over 6 years, Matthias Mehl, M-E-H-L, and his team wired up 6 separate groups of human beings, or at least university students who are close enough, 17 to 30 years of age, 396 students in all, which is reasonable sample size, and monitored them over the 6-year period, and they found that the women spoke 16,000 words against the men's 15,700.
Oh.
That's no difference. And in fact, the most talkative male person was a male. So, no, women do not speak more words than men. The men sort of grunt a lot, though. I have noticed that women are very good at talking through issues over and over again, whereas men will just pretend they never happened.
Well, you're quite good at talking, Dr. Carl.
Only on air. Other than that, I'm totally incommunicative, yeah.
Do I have time for one more question?
One more question.
Well, quick one. That myth about men being able to multitask. If I sit in front of a computer, I cannot do anything else. I can't pick up the phone and chat. I can't watch the TV. That's the one thing I can do. And there's that myth that women can multitask. Is that true? Is there any truth in that?
I don't know. I'd like to see a study on it. I do remember on one occasion I was being interviewed when I was trying to be a student at the University of New South Wales to do my biomedical engineering degree. And there was a guy in there, Peter Farrell, who was the professor of biomedical engineering, and he started to interview me, and then the phone rang. And then he answered the phone, and at the same time in between when they were talking, he kept on asking me questions and listening to what I was saying, and at the same time with his hand he was writing a paper. So he had a conversation with me, and at one stage...
That's just rude.
Because he was a very busy man. He told me, look, this is the way it is. You don't have to.
So that's a yes to multitasking?
I don't know. We have to do a large study with a large number of people. If anybody knows, in a peer-reviewed journal, not the drunk guy down at the pub or something you heard on the internet, but in a peer-reviewed journal, anything about men versus women multitasking, please let us know.
Mm.
James West, when can we catch you on the radio?
5:30 this afternoon, Becoming a Man and the Influence of Your Father on Your Masculinity. That's at 5:30 on Hack.
It's coming up at 5:30 on Hack with James and the
team.
Let
me tell you one funny thing about my father. My father was a writer and even won the Polish Journalist of the Year award. And I hated writing all my life. And when he died, suddenly I became a writer.
Let's start with Dr. Ryan from Maitland.
Dr. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Carl.
You have a question regarding bathrooms.
Yes,
toilet
I
time.
Do. My question is, why is it the closer and closer you get to the toilet, the more urgently you have to go?
With regard to a number one or a number two?
Number one. Like, you know how you'll get to the front door and you just desperately start needing to go to the toilet.
Okay. What happens is that you generate urine from your kidneys at the rate of 1 mil per minute during the daytime. Generate more in cold weather because your skin gets colder. The blood is shunted into your core and there's more blood flowing through your kidneys. And so they generate more urine.
Okay.
The bladder expands. Maximum volume of the bladder is about 300 to 700 mils, depending on whether you're tall or short, male or female.
Uh-huh.
And as it expands, like little corrugations, along the way, sensors say, we're expanding now, you should go about it. And you get several warnings along the way, so you can ignore them at first, easily, later. They are more and more difficult as it gets more and more urgent. You can avoid the desire. You can put it off by the famous gate theory, where you assume that a gate can only have one thing going through it at a time. And so if you jiggle your legs up and down and do this for about 4 or 5 minutes, you'll suddenly find at the end of jiggling up and down for 4 or 5 minutes that the desire to go to the bathroom to urinate has gone away. Now, there's a psychological fact. I have been jiggling my legs for 5 minutes and my bladder is full. Bladder says, I'm full. You got a toilet just there. Well, what are you waiting for? Get there. And that is the best explanation I can come up with as to why the urgency increases, because this time it's saying, stop messing me around, man. I don't want any more gate theory crap. Just get me there.
Okay, I see.
I think.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good enough for me.
Best of luck with your urination, Ryan.
Thank you.
All the best. Dr. Bay from the Blue Mountains joins us. Dr. Bay.
Dr. Bay, welcome.
Hello, Dr. Doctor. Bay.
Hello, Dr. Bay. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Your question is regarding red skin lollies and the effect of heat, yes?
Yeah, I was chewing a red skin lolly and then I put some ice in my mouth and then it turned hot. And then when the ice melted, it turned the red skin turns off again.
Ah, and how old are you, Dr. Bay?
9.
And you're not at school today? Or are you homeschooled? Ah, there are advantages and disadvantages to that, and I've seen many people be very happy with their homeschooling. Okay, we're talking about a thing called proteins unfolding. Now, have you heard of this three sorts of fats, three sorts of foods, fats, proteins, carbohydrates?
Yeah.
Okay, forget the other two, just think about proteins. Now, have you heard about things called amino acids?
No. No.
Okay, proteins are made up of amino acids. There's about 20 sort of amino acids. And the thing is that they've got electrical charges on them. And so when you have one amino acid, it's just sitting there in space and it's just got a shape. It might have two possible shapes, but, you know, depending on which way it folds. If you join another amino acid onto it, it can join onto maybe 4 or 5 or 10 places. And so suddenly the number of possible shapes it can have is, you know, 10. And then you join another amino acid, which has got another 5 shapes. Then you've got 50 possible combinations. By the time you get to a food that's to any sort of decent-sized protein, you have got more possible shapes than there are atoms in the universe. And so they call this the folding or unfolding problem. Look this up on Wikipedia. I think we'd have something about it. And also the latest issue of the magazine called Atomic, which is a magazine for computer nerds, talks about how they've used the computing power of all the computers that join the program called unfolding.com or folding.com to solve problems in folding proteins. So the basic thing is that as the temperature goes up, you lock the proteins into one shape. And so they can't flip from one shape to another, and so it becomes hard. And or it becomes soft, sorry. No, hang on, no, no. As the temperature goes up, there's more energy in the system, so the proteins can go this way and that way, and they're all floppy. And as the temperature goes down, the energy in the system is less, and they tend to get locked into a shape, so the lolly is hard when it's soft and floppy when it's warm. Now, I just suddenly thought at the end of that long, involved answer that there's probably not many proteins in lollies.
In a red skin.
So the answer is I don't know. And is there a food technologist or a food scientist who can ring in with the answer? So, Bae, keep listening.
Keep listening, Bae. Thanks very much for your call.
I think it's something along with the fact that as you double the temperature by, if you increase the temperature by 10 degrees C, you double the amount of energy available in the system. Okay, keep listening.
Thanks, Bae.
That's a hard question, Dr. Bae.
Things melt when they get hotter.
Things melt when they get hotter, but why?
And get hard as they get cooler.
Yeah, but you got more energy in the system. But I'm just trying to think on a molecular level, what is there that happens to the... We're talking sugar here, aren't we?
Mm.
We're not talking protein, we're talking sugars.
Yeah.
And so it's this carbohydrates. I'm trying to visualize. Maybe, I don't know.
Dr. Tanya has given us a call from Suburban. Dr. Tanya.
Hello.
Your question is regarding hair.
I was doing a quiz with my daughter and one of the questions was, what's the lifespan of hair? And the answer was 4 years. But I don't get it. What happens after 4 years? We all go bald.
Hair grows, and I've forgotten the rate. What is it, 1 to 2 millimetres a week or something like that? 5 millimetres a week? I've forgotten the exact number. But hair does grow at a certain rate. And it goes through a life cycle which has 3 phases. Phase number 1 is that it grows. Phase number 2 is that it stops growing and it rests there. And phase number 3 is that it gets pushed out when a new hair grows underneath it. So the length of the growing cycle varies. And on your skull, I think that's what they're referring to, is probably 4 years. And so typically your hair can reach down to your mid-back. And then as you get older, you lose that ability. And on your eyebrows, the growing phase is only a few weeks. Because otherwise, you'd have eyebrows that would droop over your eyes, which would be bad for you. And then in between, like on your beard, I think you can keep on growing indefinitely. Armpit hair probably falls out at a length of 2 or 5
centimetres. Because they say your hair keeps growing after you die, right?
Oh, you didn't read my 23rd book, did you?
I did not.
No.
I only got
what happens? Yeah, I know. It's a problem. They always stop at that one. What happens is that the hair does not grow, but your body dehydrates. The hair stays where it is. It has no water in it.
It's just pure protein. The body shrinks, the hair gets pushed out.
Perfect explanation. So, Dr. Tanya, to answer your question, I think they're referring to the length of the growing phase in the hair that's on your skull, not the hair that's on your... the hair on the top of your skull, not the hair that's on the front of your skull above your eyes, the eyebrows. I think that's what they're referring to.
Now, Dr. Carr, we wanted to follow up on a few questions from last week, but just quickly, do you reckon we can do one more very quickly?
Please, let's go for another one.
Dr. Daniel.
Dr. Daniel?
Yes, g'day, wonderful Dr. Carr and Dr. Zanishelli, MD. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Daniel.
Now, Dr. Carr, I was wondering if you could enlighten me on the mysterious story of the Min Min, if it is a ball of gas or if it's some sort of elusive creature.
Now I've actually been out that part of Queensland, which is Boolea and Winton, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, and you've got that incredibly sticky mud in Winton, where I also almost bogged my unstoppable four-wheel drive with diff locks on each axle. I almost got bogged in somebody's front yard, where they also found lots of dinosaurs. Now, they've got these Min Min lights, which are strange lights that no matter how far you drive, you never get close to them.
Okay.
And this is the story, and lots of people have seen them. Now, in a few cases, the Min Min lights have actually been the reflection on the wires, on the telegraph wires, of headlights of a car in the other direction. But we're talking about the case where there are no telegraph wires. The best explanations that we can come up with are lights from over the horizon reflected by temperature inversions, weird temperature things. I have not been able to read or find of a scientific explanation in a peer-reviewed journal of the Min Min lights. So there are these lights that appear at night and you drive for ages and ages. There have been stories about methane gas, and in some cases methane gas can cause problems, but if you saw that movie Men in Black, you know that it's always used as a stand explanation before they flash the neuralizer at you, after they flash the neuralizer. Look, I think, Dr. Dan, the Min Min lights are still a bit of a mystery.
Yep. Now, is it true that they occur in other countries, such as America, and they're called the jack-o'-lantern or will-o'-wisp over there?
Yeah, I've heard. I wrote a story about this in my eighth book, which is a long time ago, and I haven't followed it up. So, yes, that they do appear in other countries, which makes me think is not just the UFO people deciding to appear to you in an entirely obscure way in only a few parts of the world, but rather that these few parts of the world share the same geometry of large flat areas and even temperatures.
Thanks for your call, Dr. Daniel.
Very interesting.
Thank you, Dr. Daniel. Hope that clears it up for you. So there you go. Now, Dr. Carl, last week we had someone who called in and asked the question. He said that he'd heard about the ability to recharge your phone via sending a text message, that you could hypothetically text someone and your phone battery would be full again.
Yes.
Do you have some follow-up information?
Well, at the time I was skeptical because I didn't see how you could put more electrons into the battery just by putting some numbers into the screen of your phone.
Seems a little far-fetched, doesn't it?
Well, everything's more complicated than it seems. Okay, so somebody then said that in some countries, but I couldn't find any further reference on this, that in some okay, bit of background. Your battery is actually a very sophisticated thing. Gone are the days when it was just a thing with lead and acid in it, but now it's got lithium and it has electronics in it. And it's not allowed to go totally flat because it's only got a couple of hundred cycles and it's got to be kept in a certain range of never too flat, never too full. And if you let it go totally flat, you lose a few of the cycles of operation. Because people now regard the life of their battery before they have to buy a new one as an important thing. And so you don't want the battery to go all the way flat. So the first explanation, which other people poo-pooed, was that if you are ringing an emergency phone number, you are in an emergency situation, and therefore it bypasses the circuitry in the battery that protects the battery from getting fully flat. And it says, we don't care about the fact that you've lost 5 cycles out of your 200 cycles. What we want is that you get out the message now. And if we can give you 2 extra minutes of talk time, and that saves your life, and the battery goes flat, and you've lost 5 cycles, in a year's time, that doesn't matter. But other people poo-pooed this. That was the first answer as to how putting
in... Are you saying that's something most phones have that?
Well, it was said... Mm. It was claimed that this exists in some phones, but then other people said, no, that's just all rubbish, and it was just a made-up story. But the second one is real. You can go into some phones, and I won't mention their brand name, but you can look it up on the Twitter homepage, drcarl.com, drcarl.com, and you can. They mention the brand of the phone, and you can actually plug in some numbers into your phone, and that will make your battery go flat faster and give you higher voice quality. Mm-hmm. So by plugging these numbers into a certain brand of phone, you can go to a higher quality and make your battery go faster. There is not a setting the other way.
So you can only flatten your battery faster.
And
not as useful.
And the default setting is that you're always having the longer battery life. So maybe if you're there with a broken leg, dying slowly, with your battery almost flat, you can think, oh yeah, I did actually set it to the higher quality, shorter battery life. While I'm bleeding to death, I'll just reset it and then I can make my phone call last a little bit longer. So that's sort of where we stand with the story about being able to put numbers into your phone to increase the battery life.
I see.
Okay, now we have the infrared photograph thing.
Yes, yes, we must move rather quickly.
Now, somebody has actually, on the Twitter homepage, given a couple of homepages or URLs, email addresses, or addresses, web addresses, of what looked to me like infrared photos. I think they look too good. I think that they may have been somebody learning how to use Photoshop in Photoshop 101. Here, you're doing Photoshop 101, fake the top half of this photograph so it looks like you've got an infrared photograph and make sure it's outside. But it does look very good, but I want more information. What sort of camera, what day it was, what infrared camera did you use, how do you actually do
there
it?
You go. If that was you pointing your infrared camera at the rainbow, give us a call, 1-300-055-36. And we'll chat about next week and find out whether it was legit or not. Dr. Carl, thank you very much for coming in. Thank you to all our callers this week. Where can we catch you next, Dr. Carl? Here next Thursday.
Oh, actually, right now, if you flip over to the BBC in London, you can hear me live on the BBC.
Is that right?
Yeah, in 7 seconds.
In about 7 seconds. Hey, VJ's coming up next. You are on Triple J.